Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
To our program, Take It From Us, for another week. How are you doing? Hope you've looked after yourself as best as you can these last few days. Man, how much illness is out there at the moment? How many bugs? Everyone seems to be crook. My daughter picked up something else last week. This would have to be a world record for our family. The number of illnesses and viruses, and we've had, what, COVID this year? We've had the flu. How many sore throats? How many sneezes? The tissue. If you were in the tissue box industry, you'd be going okay at the moment, wouldn't you? But we battle on and we do our best. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you're staying warm. I hope you're staying dry. Last week, as part of our program, we spoke about the use of language and the power of language. And something that had come up at the Transforming Mental Health Conference a week earlier was the use of the word seclusion. And we referenced this last week. Seclusion. We know what that is. A lot of you listening know what that is firsthand. And what if we change that word to solitary confinement? Takes on a completely different ring. Exactly the same practice, exactly the same situation, different use of language. And Caleb reached out to us during the week here at Take It From Us and had this to say. He said, "Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you bringing this and this topic, because I do agree that the language that we use every day when we're talking about health and well-being is critical and crucial to the mental well-being of those that we are talking to and talking about. Seclusion, a great example of that. There's nothing secluded about being locked in a room and being left there and being willfully cut off from other members of society for an undisclosed period of time. And so if we were to throw solitary confinement at the people who actually lock people away, maybe we might get some change. It might help." And Caleb also talked about, say, concussion. We talk about the word concussion. People suffer a concussion. You know, it's been a huge topic in sport and collision and contact sports for the last few years, concussions. What if we actually change the language around those and call them brain injuries? What do you think of that? Because that's what it is. If we injured any other part of our body, we'd say that. Injured leg, injured hamstring, or whatever. When you have a concussion, it is a brain injury. And perhaps if people actually stopped and thought about it that way, they might take better care of themselves. You know, type 2 diabetes, there's now a push for that to be called processed food disease. It's a little bit confronting, isn't it, when you hear language like that, processed food disease for type 2 diabetes. But what it's actually doing, it's empowering people to actually think about what it might be that's causing them the problem. And in the case of type 2 diabetes, we know almost exclusively it's too much processed food, too much sugar. So maybe if we change the wording, change the language, it might help to change the meaning for people. Yeah, again, something to think about. Give us your thoughts on that. You know, people often think that tweaking language, changing words is overblowing things or actually not actually doing a hell of a lot to change the situation. I think words, language, context really matters. I think it does. I think words count. And sometimes the way in which we use words can have a profound impact and effect on the way in which we develop these conversations. and, you know, develop strategies. So give us your thoughts on that. Really appreciate Caleb's thoughts today on Take It From Us. Please leave us a note, as I said earlier, facebook.com, Take It From Us. Still to come on the program today, we'll talk to Claire Conza from Make Give Live. Now, this organisation became famous just a couple of years ago when a certain royal baby wore a beanie. You might be familiar with this story. We'll check that out with Claire very soon on our program. First up, though, today we have Hannah Whitaker Komatsu. Hannah was a speaker at the Transforming Mental Health Conference just a couple of weeks ago. She was great. She spoke really well. She spoke really powerfully and captivated the entire room. Hannah is a lived experienced advisor for the Ministry of Health. She's also the chairperson for Thriving Madly. This is a community that was established in Christchurch. We need to know more about this and we need to hear Hannah's story. So Hannah, thank you so much for joining us on our program today.
Oh, kia ora, Kent. Thank you for having me.
How was it for you speaking publicly at the Transforming Mental Health Conference a week or two ago?
It was all right. I do a bit of speaking. It was a different sort of environment and navigating different hats and different roles. So, yeah, no, but it was really good. It was lovely. It was lovely to have been asked. So,
yeah, and you spoke really well and you spoke with such great clarity. And I think you motivated a few people in the room. And that's partly why we wanted to get you on today to have a chat. But also, you know, we want to hear about your story and how it is that you've come from where you were to where you are now. Just on the public speaking, though, it's probably still, isn't it, for most people, the number one thing that they're fearful of still. And as I reckon, I think maybe this has just occurred to me, it's because when we stand up in front of a room full of people, we feel like we're being judged by everyone else who's looking at us.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, public speaking. It's, speaking in public about my journey, about my story, around how context has impacted on my experience has been a big part of my life, right from probably going back to my 20s. So I still get nervous speaking in front of people, but I'm also mindful that the purpose of speaking is not just about me. It's about the perspectives that you are sharing more broadly with the community that might not necessarily get to be heard. So that gives me a sense of not just speaking for me, that the judgment that I might be experiencing might be for many people. And I can weather that because I'm very fortunate to have had a sanctuary to return to in terms of my community and my whānau that have loved and accepted me even when I've been travelling in spaces where there's lots of judgment attached to that. So.
So, Hannah, you're a lived experienced advisor for the Ministry of Health, and also we'll get to that, but tell us about your role as chairperson of the Thriving Madly community.
Yeah, so that's my... So my role as chairperson. So Thriving Madly is a mutual support community based out of Otatahi, Christchurch, and we believe that it is through mutual support that we will weather the storms of life, crafting wisdom and beauty that benefits not only ourselves and one another, but also the broader community. So we're not a service. We're a group of humans who all have a lived experience of mental distress, difference, and some form of substance or gambling harm, and that what I affectionately refer to ourselves as mad, bad, or just straight weird. We stake claim to an identity of lived experience from a particular perspective, and it's not just about what's happened to us. It's about understanding our experiences in context, looking in a particular way to craft knowledge, which is our way. So we have a way of looking at things that we craft knowledge. It's a way of seeing things, which then informs the actions that we take with the intention of taking those actions to change context in order to change the experience of those who come after, or sometimes even ourselves as we continue to journey through experiences. So we see that we can use our lived experience to create a loop of influence that changes context in order to change experience so that others don't experience the crap that we went through. So, so that's us. We were established out of a huge amount of frustration on my part around around one, what it meant, how society saw me as someone who journeyed with enduring mental distress, in that positioning as me as being disordered, where in actual fact I saw that from my experiences. Well, the reason why I got to today was because of this thing that psychiatry called disorder and dysfunction. Where in actual fact, as I learned to navigate life with these experiences, I was able to build an incredible strength from them without them leaving me, rather working with them. And also seeing that often within services, including peer support services, what we could find was that while we got rid of institutionalisation in buildings, we'd essentially created a community institutionalisation where people just got transferred from one service to another service to another service, and that as opposed to being supported to form organic connections in the community. And often that was because our communities were not places of belonging. They were not communities of belonging. So I was like, right, we need to think about how can we shift community spaces to be one where people feel like they belong, where relationships are organic, where people are mutually supporting someone as opposed to having a set of priorities driven by a funder to determine what kind of support you can get, where you are only receiving as opposed to giving, and your identity continues to be that of someone who has to be cared for as opposed to being seen as someone who can do both, who can be loved and cared for but can also provide love and care for others.
And the support that you've been able to offer yourself and others, and that sense of community, because and we know that loneliness is just terrible, and it's something that we all need to kind of rage against, isn't it? In a nice way. What are the results that you've seen from this approach?
So what we've seen is this sort of a growing community. It started off with a group of young people who were, we started off with what we call was a youth committee, and that's just sort of gone from there. We train our community peoples in intentional peer support, so we have a mass of people who understand relationships through this sort of lens of intentional peer support, which shifts how we travel through hard times. That's just kind of growing. And from that, we also have some online spaces where we support people. We do a whole lot of different sorts of activities. So we have these things called Black Dog Walk-Offs where we gather together and we go for a walk. It's essentially just coffee for me. And you don't have to have a dog, but you could have a dog. Some people come because they want to be with the dogs, not with the other humans. And we do, we put on variety shows, so burlesque variety shows, so on different themes. So we've had a show that was called Psychosis, which was looking at the intersection between the experience of gender and mental distress. We had one that was called Rants in Their Pants, which was looking at venting the everyday frustrations of life that contribute to our experiences of distress. Oh, that's my dog.
He's heard you talking about dogs.
Yeah, he has. He's like, I'm all about it.
And now he's into it.
He's into it. And yeah, so we put on shows. We also have these things called Crafternoons where people come together. So what we're focused on is not just doing things together that are about our experiences, but doing things that are about our lives, which is informed by the intentional peer support sort of concept around moving towards how can I look at myself and my experiences and the world around me in new ways to craft new possibilities. You know, we've also trained people in what we call mutual advocacy, which is where we learn to travel with one another and figure out around self-advocating, train people in facilitation, so people in our community will be holding space for one another. There's on our website, there's a whole lot of stuff around our philosophy. So we have a small role for a wonderful person called Sarah, and she is our community aspirations facilitator. And so what she does is she listens to the community and then from those aspirations within the community around what's needed, then we move towards creating it. So one of our recent things is we've got a thriving autistically group that is starting, and that's come about from a group of wonderful people who thought, right, this is, I need a space to navigate this. It doesn't exist for me in a way that works for me at the moment. Can we create it from within our community where we don't feel like we have to go to a service in order to navigate how we're going to thrive as autistic people? And boom, we've got this little group forming. So we have a charitable trust that supports us to access funding, but instead of governance structure normally being something that drives where the where a community or space is heading, we hold a mutuality between what we refer to everybody who connects with us as being contributors. You're a contributor right now, Kent, because you're contributing to people hearing a little bit more about us. The governance group, the board, and the community have to navigate together how we do things. So in terms of decisions that we make around events that might be a little bit risky, then that's something that we navigate together. We don't get to determine as a board what the community wants. And the community can't go and do a whole lot of stuff because they understand that their decisions will impact on us. Like if they set the stage on fire at one of our shows, it's going to be the board members that will have a problem. So there's this navigating between. So it's an upside down structure to what you'd see in most spaces and in most peer-led organisations. So.
Take it from us. We're talking with Hannah Whittaker-Komatsu on our program today. Do you ever encounter much resistance now to people with lived experience as being, I guess, credible as far as looking after others? As you know, I don't know whether we're talking about clinicians here or other people who might still be sceptical or still be questioning your place and your role.
Do you mean within the Ministry of Health or do you mean generally?
Yeah, generally. Do you find, are you getting much pushback these days from people who would diminish your ability to help others because you're not an expert, let's say?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know if my personal experience of that is that's not something that I experience, and perhaps that's around how I am and the lens that I bring. People also need to understand that I have a social work background, so I was trained in social work for a short period of time. The diploma I haven't, yeah. So. But what I hear from people is the ongoing challenge around what it means to be someone who steps into the space when you have been someone who's connected with services or had. A lot of that's determined by diagnosis, so how people connect to your diagnosis, how you convey your experiences also, so how you talk about them, the story that you paint for people when you speak about your experiences. I also think as well that... it can be around what other people's experience of people in lived experience roles has been. And so I have this real understanding that when I step into a space, I don't just step into a space as Hannah with a lived experience and a lived experience role. I step into a space and often creating this moment that I'm creating with another person is actually a moment that will inform the people who come after me, the people who are alongside me, what their experience in a relationship with this person will look like. I understand that the person connecting to me, often they've been socialised into a particular way about understanding people like me, a story about my particular diagnoses, and so that then contributes to how they interact with me. It's often a gift when someone is blatantly in the past, when people have been blatantly when I've experienced epistemic injustice, yeah, where my diagnosis has impacted on my credibility and it's blatant and I can see it. Mm. I try to situate that as a gift that's being given to me in order to look at how I can shift that thinking so that the next person like me that they encounter or has a similar story to me that they encounter will experience something different. And that's tiring and hard, but that's how I try to navigate that. A lot of it is actually around managing my own self-stigma and around what it means for me to navigate the messages about me from the world around me.
Mm. And how do you do that?
I situate myself in context. So situate myself in context, so I understand that the people around me are also only understanding, are also only understanding things based by all that they hear. Let me just think that through. So what do? I ground down to the truth about me. So what do I know about me? And think about my way in which I've come to understand my experiences, so the languaging that I use. So for me, the self-stigma will rear up as you're disordered, you're broken, you've got a broken brain because of the things that happened to you when you were little. Other people wouldn't respond like that. There's something wrong with you. What I grind myself back down into is the understanding that I hold for other people, that they are not broken, that they are able to craft new futures for themselves, and that the thing for me is that with my way of being, if I had not developed and grown up in to be this person with this multiple sense of self, I would not have survived so much of the life that I had. So there's nothing wrong with me in the way I developed. It's around what I grew up in. And so understanding that this beautiful survival mechanism, understanding this survival mechanism as beautiful, is what allows me to challenge that. And it's essentially that I wouldn't judge other people for the reality of me. So if I judge myself like that, then that's a little bit bullshit. So it's I look for evidence that supports me to understand that those lies that the world says about us are not truths, because I've got this evidence pool that I have. So I have there's a whole lot of skills and practices that I do to keep that evidence pool close to home. So like normally at the moment we're selling a house and my room's empty, but normally my room is covered with reminders of truths. So I used to carry around me with a truth and lies notebook where I understood and would listen to the dialogue that came from my parts, and I would craft that down, and then over time I would establish an evidence pool on the other side of the page around what the truth about my identity and about who I was sat with that. And I would carry it around in my bag, because then I didn't need to remind myself. I just knew I carried a truth with me. And so when I heard that nastiness, I was able to understand that there was a truth with it. And over time, I got to understand where those stories about me had come from, how those parts had formed those particular worldviews. And then was able to establish a new way of communicating about those. So it's all very weird and complex. But the bottom line is, self-stigma is an ongoing practice of undoing what the world tells you about you, and checking in with yourself that you are not reiterating what the world says about you. So that's the whole story.
And the messaging has to be stronger to all of us, to ourselves. Not broken. We don't need fixing. That we are whole, that we're capable, and that we're resourceful. We just might need a steer in the right direction. And someone like yourself, who's been through a lot, might be the right person to put your arm around somebody else and share your experience to help them get through theirs. Can you tell us a little bit about your own experience in life, Hannah, and getting from where you were to where you are today at 45?
Yeah, give it a go. Well, it's quite mind-blowing for me when I walk through the doors of the Ministry of Health, in Wellington. I was essentially homeless for a period of time in my youth, so I never pictured in Wellington, I never pictured that I would be in the position I am. So, Kent, for me, I first entered services when I was 7 and a half, and it was because at the time in Aotearoa there was no services for children who'd experienced the type of violence that I had in my home, and so on my disclosure, my mum ended up within the mental health system, and so did I. So my first interaction with services was to be observed through one of those wacky mirrors with my mum playing, and it just reiterated that there was something wrong with me as opposed to there being something wrong with the world. And so that started my journey. Interestingly, though, I've been reflecting upon my journey to lived experience spaces, and that coincided with a period of time in Aotearoa history where there was this deinstitutionalisation. And so my mum was connected with a whole lot of people who were in this process of deinstitutionalisation and figuring out how did they navigate life in the community. And so I grew up in this space with other people who were trying to navigate what is this world being now. And so that was kind of a space of lived experience sense making. You know, how do we do things differently? Then alongside that, when I was in my early, I think I was like 10 or 11, my mum established a support network for mothers of sexually abused children. And so I saw her own lived experience being shaped to create action and change so that people didn't go through the things that my mum went through in terms of having to leave family and whānau in order to keep me safe. But I didn't recognise that was a contribution to my absolute and utter passion around lived experience ability to shape and create change. So anyway, I journeyed through services. I had my first hospitalisation as a 15-year-old in an acute adult inpatient unit here, what was called Sunnyside. And it was deeply impactful and again sort of contributed to the story about there being something wrong with me. And there were all of these kind of predictions cast across my life. There were stories like you won't sustain long-term relationships because of your diagnosis. I remember going to careers advice in my 20s and being told that I wasn't fit for academic study because of my background. And even in my 20s when I was looking at studying social work, I was told, you know, that would be going to be too triggering for me. And yet here we are. So in terms of peer support, the first peer support that I actually connected to was when I walked through the doors as a 17-year-old at the New Zealand Prostitutes Collective in Christchurch here. And all of a sudden, here I was connected to a group of humans who were actually able to support me to understand things in ways that, yeah, you could go to a sexual health provider and they could teach you to put on a condom. But you walk through the doors of the Prostitutes Collective and they could teach you to navigate sex, to have conversations around how do you do these things, how do you operate within a system, all of those things. And so all of a sudden here I was connecting. Perhaps the biggest impact for me was around the fact that these people were able to counter the story that I heard within the broader world about what it meant to be a prostitute. And here were these women who were so articulate, who were able to talk about the impacts of all sorts of different things and ways. And it wasn't just the same story about who prostitutes were or how they behaved. But I didn't hang around much because I was deeply involved in a gang scene and life was very chaotic. And yet when I became pregnant with my boy and I left all of that stuff behind me and I went and did a survivors group, I had this sudden revelation where I realised the violence I experienced in the industry wasn't just the responsibility of the people who harmed me, but it was actually broader society for the way that they position sex workers as being acceptable victims. And so I went back to the Prostitutes Collective and the beautiful Anna was still there and I said to her, this is what I think. And she was like, oh, you're great, read this book. So I went away and read this book and it had all of these stories of people like me. And so it was this sort of understanding and it has some theoretical lens to why these things happen for people. And, you know, sex work was work and that we were valuable beings. And so then I went back and I said, I want to volunteer. And so that was when I started working in that space. And so I had the pleasure of coinciding again with the decriminalisation of sex work and I started working. So for me, the interesting thing is peer support lived experience isn't just the property of mental health and or addiction, that it's actually a much broader context much broader range of context that it's involved within. But yeah, so then I went and did a whole lot of things, burnt and fried, big time, thought I wouldn't work with people again, and then was supported beautifully by my employers to step back into work. And so I worked in some other sort of social service spaces, including care and protection and youth justice, a leader program, did these bits and pieces, and then realised my boy was now the same age as these beautiful young people I was working with, and I was much more of a mum worker than I was a youth worker. And so that was when I stepped into mental health. And so that kind of weaved my way through to where I am today. I've got no idea if this is what I'm wanting in terms of my lived experience.
Absolutely.
Each Thank of you. Those things has built upon the understanding around how we get to where we are today. Isn't built upon one single choice or decision. It's built upon many, and it's built upon people being prepared to open doors for you. And I have been very blessed to have people open doors for me. And it's my desire to make sure that the roles that I work within are door-opening roles, and that they create pathways for people's voices to get to decision-makers in ways that are meaningful and can be understood. And also that people are able to understand the perspectives of people who are making decisions that shape policy, that inform their lives.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Wanted to ask you with one final question, because it was something that you brought up at the conference a couple of weeks ago, the importance of all of us, the onus really on everybody, to think about who's not being heard and to look for people who are not being heard. How do we do that?
Well, it's a really big question, Ken? I think it's around creating a transparency for how people can be heard, and that I think often processes are not accessible to all, even when they're in all sorts of different accessible formats, because there are people who are choosing which voices get to be heard, if they align with their perspectives or if they don't align with their perspectives, especially when we're talking about social change. So there's a real, for me, and I'm speaking for myself here and for my Thriving Medley community, there are many different perspectives around these things that we call experiences of distress. I'm very clear that the language of disorder for me is profoundly unhelpful and paints me as being a disorder and me as a human as being an illness, whereas someone else, the language around disorder for them fits perfectly and works for them around understanding their behaviour as being disordered and that they need to do things differently. Now, if I was not careful, then I could inadvertently only allow or create pathway for people who also believed, like me, these particular things. But that's not fair. And that's not right, because if we these experiences are so broad and they're so personal and they're so unique, we need to ensure that there is this space for all. So for me, part of the biggest bit is actually getting over your own perspective. And so just because you're the expert on yourself doesn't mean that you're the expert on everybody else. And so often when we sit in lived experience positions, we're like, the clinicians are not the expert. I'm the expert on me. Yeah, you're the expert on you, but you're not the expert on everybody else. You're not the expert on Kent. You're not the expert on other people. They're the expert on them. What your job is to look for the weavings between and to question why those differences sit there, why those differences are there, what within the person's context, environment, sense-making has meant that that particular thing has become valuable for them, that worldview, that understanding, that knowledge is valuable for them, and then reflect upon why is that the case for me? Why is that different for me? Because then we can understand what works, what doesn't work. What do we want for those who come after us? How do we want to do that? So that was probably be my... That was a very long way of saying we need to get over ourselves and be open to there being different perspectives and making sure that we create space for all to be heard.
Well, I guess for me it would be empathetic, which means trying to see that person from the position they're in rather than putting yourself in that position and actually listening. Yeah. We need to do better at listening. Hey, and it's been so nice to actually be able to sit here and listen to your story. And thanks for sharing it, Hannah, and for inspiring everybody with the work that you've been doing. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me. And thanks for asking the questions. And, you know, one bit at a time, eh? Things matter. Small things matter each and every
day. They do. Yeah, they do.
Interaction, yeah.
Hannah Whitaker Komatsu with us on Take It From Us, a lived experienced advisor with the Ministry of Health and also the chairperson of Thriving Madly, a really awesome community that has been put together, born in Christchurch. You can check them out by looking for Thriving Madly online. little Kiwi music on Take It From Us. That is L.A.B. with In The Air. Claire Konza is the creator of Make Give Live. Now, Claire created this social enterprise through her own experience of depression when she was pregnant and is good enough to join us on the program. Claire, thank you so much for your time and talking to us today. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this chat.
Yeah. Before we get into the background of your own life and where you've got to now, I can't help but note that Make Give Live became quite popular. It was, I think the word is trending a little while ago.
Yeah, I think we fondly call that the Archie effect these days. But yes, Megan and Harry's Archie photo that appeared throughout world media a couple of years ago definitely had an effect on our little social enterprise.
Great. And tell us about Make Give Live and what it is that you do.
Sure. So Make Give Live is a social enterprise, so it's part business, part charity, with the purpose of easing isolation and improving mental health and well-being through the therapies of social connection and mindful making with purpose. So we have groups of people that get together every week in their local cafe or community hub or library and have a good laugh and chat and catch up and cuppa and make a collection of beanie, hand-knitted or crocheted, that to sustain ourselves we sell as buy one, give one. So for everyone that we sell, we give one to a New Zealander in need through a few different charities that we work with. And that just really gives us the purpose to our maker community as well, you know, that they're using tools for good as well as connecting. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. How long has it been going and how many participants, how many contributors do you have?
We're coming up 5 years and we now have a maker community who meet in groups of about 150, and we also launched last year a Give Club where people could receive, well, partly in response to lockdowns and COVID, receive kits from home that they make the Give beanie for and then send back up to us. So, yeah, about 250 in total.
Do you have like a waiting list? Do you have people who want to join but for whatever reason they can't get there at the moment?
Yeah, that's our biggest challenge. It's about 500 at the moment. And we're just, yeah, really working on our sort of behind the scenes, getting all the foundations and everything in place to be able to grow sustainably and get more of those people involved. So, yeah, we've been going through a bit of a change process. We were operating as just a company, but we've recently established a charitable trust to run alongside with a couple of awesome trustees. And so we've got some great things in the pipeline to be to keep more people involved.
Yeah, I guess as they would say, it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, exactly. One of my mentors calls it burdened with glorious purpose. I like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that could be patented, that phrase.
Yeah, it's a goodie. He has many. The other one that I love is knitting society back together.
Wow, that's great.
Yep. That is call out Miles. He's one of our trustees on the charitable trust.
Because often we talk about, you know, little old ladies and their knitting needles. It's not actually the case in all cases, is it?
No, not at all. And part of my inspiration was these instances where intergenerational connection was really powerful for both young and old, like kindergartens going into old age homes or students going to live in older age villages. And, yeah, just the power of that interaction and benefit to all. So, yeah, knitting has become quite trendy and popular again, especially through COVID and lockdowns. People have sort of taken on more crafty things to do at home, and obviously the mindfulness benefit of it. And so, yeah, there's so many videos on YouTube. There's so many young self-taught YouTube knitters out there. And, yeah, there's a lot of sort of trend around it now as well. So whilst you may think of it as a bit of a dying skill in a lot of older people, it's definitely touching a younger generation as well. And Make Give Live has been able to tap into both. And that's one of the beauties of our group, is that they are, you know, they range from 20 years old up to 90 years old. And some of the mums bring their kids in as well. So again, there's like that beautiful through all the generations connection happening.
Yeah. It's not a dying skill, because it is needed. And look, I've had a couple of kids, and the best, the most thoughtful, most lovely gifts that we got that would bring tears to my eyes would be handmade from someone's nana or someone's friend. And they heard about, you know, we're having a little girl, we're having a little boy, and the heart felt, the heart and the soul and the good wishes that get sent with that little bundle of wool is just amazing, the effect that it had on me and has on my partner and also other people, you know?
Yeah, there's so much love knitted into those. We call them head and heart warmers. And for the, you know, the recipients of the New Zealanders in Real Need that we give to, it's not just warmth, it's, you know, that fact of care, that somebody cared enough for them to hand make them something. You're so right, it's so special. Mm. And the makers sign their names on the tag as well, so it's just got that element of, you know, real people involved and care, and yeah, so much more than a warm thing.
And your personal story, Claire, why is knitting, or how has knitting, I guess, influenced or changed your life?
Yeah, sure. My grandmother had taught me as a child, and that was a really special connection, but I hadn't done it for many years. And when I got pregnant, I got incredibly sick. I had hyperemesis, so I was in and out of hospital, and I got prenatal depression, which I didn't even know existed till I had it. I'd heard a lot about postnatal, but I was in a really dark place. I couldn't work, I couldn't do much, and it was a scary place. I just remember this overwhelming urge to like escape my body and mind. And the only things that made me feel better at the time were being around people and getting back into knitting. I have a friend who's really good, and she helped me get back into it and helped me make a few things for my baby. And I just, it wasn't till years later in another difficult situation that I was dreaming up Make Give Live, that I was remembering back to that and how the process of is almost meditative, forming the stitches kind of broke down the negative thought patterns and allowed me to just really focus in on something. And then by the end of producing something, you've got that, you know, boost of, yay, I made something beautiful at the end of it as well. So yeah, I really remembered back to that and how powerful it was in terms of helping me through that tricky time.
So it can be time with your own, time to yourself, time to get into that kind of mindful space. Or on the flip side, you could be conversing and laughing and joking and have that social connection as you're stitching. But it's also the actual physical act, which is good for you and therapeutic. Plus, then you get that sense of achievement at the end. Is that, have I got that right?
Yes. And then there's the extra element of giving.
The giving.
So, it's all beautifully woven into this model that just seems to work beautifully and really touches people. And I think that's, you know, why we've got so many people keen to be involved. But also, I think just touching on that social side, you know, they take their knitting home and they can do it at home, but that session where they catch up is really beautiful in the sense that after meeting for weeks and weeks and months and years, they become like family. And even the ones that are introverts and, you know, when they're going through a hard time might actually struggle to reach out. Actually just being there for a purpose of knitting and being around other people, whether you're that active in the conversation or not, is just really kind of therapeutic in the sense that you're part of something and you're not alone and you're getting that company, even if you're someone that struggles to reach out. Because knowing myself, sometimes when you're struggling, it's hard to reach out and want to connect. But when you've got something like that that's a routine and, you know, you show up every week and people are expecting you there, it kind of helps you stay in that that rhythm and routine that, you know, is supporting you. And I think that's really powerful. It's something really proactive that people can do. Some people might be struggling with mental health, or they might be really lonely, or they might just be an amazing knitter and want to give back using their skills. I think it's that mix of different people at different stages and reasons for wanting to be involved that makes it so special.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've built in just that little layer of accountability too, where you're wanting to be there for others as well as yourself.
Yeah, that's right. We were just talking about it in one of the groups the other day. You know, sometimes when you just maybe don't feel like getting up that morning and you just, you know that, you know, you want to know how so-and-so did with that big meeting they had, or so-and-so did with that operation that they had, and just check in on people and know that, you're part of something. So that's powerful.
I imagine, Claire, this group has had an enormous impact on people's lives, the people that you get to see every week. Have you got a favourite story or anything in particular that brings a smile to your face when you think about what someone said to you?
There have been so many comments that I get from them about, you know, what it means to them, and for some of them, that thing they look forward to every week, and for some of them, even how it saved their lives. And the most powerful one is probably my own story after my daughter's death. I was supposed to be going to a central group who I, you know, used to run the group and see a lot, but promised to go and see them, and I was feeling like really not sure if I was going to be ready and able to be around people. And it was the first session that one of the younger women, Malu, who's from overseas, had brought her new baby along to. All the ladies were oohing and ahhing over this baby and having cuddles. And I just remember going and feeling so welcome and so at home, and getting to have probably the last cuddle with the new baby and have her fall asleep in my arms. I was really contemplative and quiet and taking it all in and just really thinking to myself how special it is.
And the difference, the gap between isolation and loneliness to connection can be huge, but it can also be one quick car ride or a little walk, and you've changed into a different, you're there, you're in a group, your mindset's changed just like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I also think it's really important for us to think about proactively looking after our mental health and well-being. There's a lot of focus on the bottom of the cliff, but you know, just doing things like that that we know are going to keep us well. Human connection is just massive. I think are just really important, especially for a lot of our members who reach retirement and older. You know, it can be quite an unfolding time, as well as becoming a new mum and these sort of stages in life where it's easy to become isolated. And I just think that, doing proactive things like that is really important.
Mm. And I guess you've got many, many people queuing up for these lovely beanies, particularly off the back of the publicity that you had a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that has been great. And we were lucky to sort of gain an international following and customer base from that. But certainly the last couple of years through COVID have been really challenging on the business front, and particularly with rising freight costs. So a lot of our sort of customers in the US and the UK and around are sort of, you know, struggling to support. Freight costs have doubled. So we're in the process of working with a fulfillment center in the US to send a bunch of stock over there to make that more affordable. But just really appreciate the support of the locals, the New Zealanders. It's one of those brands that people really sort of attach to the purpose behind and want to support, and we've got an amazing, you know, loyal customer base who they might have a warm beanie and maybe their kids do, but then they make such beautiful gifts, and especially the baby ones as well. So yeah, it's been wonderful having that ongoing support, and there's just so much potential out there as well to reach more.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a beautiful story. And how do people get hold of you, Claire?
Just on the website, makegivelive.com. There is a form on there if people are interested in being involved in groups. We sort of map them all out. So we need a cluster in an area and somebody willing to be a group leader. We're making plans to set more groups up. But also we have beautiful beanies for sale on our website, as well as kits for those who love to make their own, for all the makers out there. So, just makegivelive.com.
Absolutely brilliant. And look, thank you so much for sharing your time and some inspiration with us today. It's like a little scattering of gold dust, Claire. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Claire Konza on Take It From Us. Fast running out of program, but as we always do each week, we have our Sheldon shout out to just throw some dap the way of a person or some people who we believe, you know, are upholding the true values of what should make a lovely society by contributing in the best possible way. Karen, who have we got this week?
Well, Ken, I've spent much of the last week or two enjoying watching the Birmingham Commonwealth Games. I just wanted to give a shout out to all the athletes from all the countries that go there, and they put so much time and effort, and some of them are under a lot of pressure from themselves, from their sport, from their fans, but they give it their all, and I just have a great time watching it, and it just relaxes me too. So I might have had a rough day or something, and I can come in, just turn that on, and I find myself feeling good about sport and just about the world in general. All the bad stuff's gone out the other side. But also, there was someone at the Commonwealth Games that we know.
Yes.
Yes.
Keely O'Hagan.
To Keely O'Hagan.
Didn't she do well too, the New Zealand high jumper? Yeah, Laura and I sat down and watched this together on, I think it was Saturday night for memory, and she did so well. I really enjoyed it. You know, she finished in the top six. She had a personal best. And you know what, Karen? She looked happy. She looked content. She looked happy. She did or disheartened that she didn't win a medal. She, you know, if you go to a major event, sporting event, and you get a personal best, that's basically all you can ask of yourself. And I just thought it was wonderful. And I found myself instinctively reaction that I wasn't aware I'd be making, thrusting my arms in the air every time she made a successful jump.
Yeah, no, it was great to watch her. Great to watch. And as you say, she was really happy with her results. So, for what she's been through to get there, well done to her. So, for her and all the other athletes at the Commonwealth Games, congratulations.
Thanks, Karen. And yeah, they always leave a hole, don't they, afterwards when we finish up with a major sporting event for the first two or three days afterwards. It feels a bit weird because you're getting so used to watching it all. But, yeah, special mention to Keely O'Hagan. She was a guest on our program a few weeks ago. She's now 28 years of age. She had a tough time of it many years ago. She's turned her life around. She qualified for the Games representing New Zealand and set a personal best just a few days ago. Tremendous performance. And, you know, I felt proud of her, and really glad that she did so well, and I just hope she feels really content and proud of herself and has that great sense of fulfillment for what she did and for all of the other athletes as well. Well done. Thanks to Karen for producing our program. Thanks to Hannah Whitaker Komatsu and Claire Konza, our special guests this week. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll talk again next week here on Take It From Us.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.
Tēnā koe Māori, tēnā koe Māori. Ui, tēnā. Yuppie! I was just wondering, could you tell me some more about the Tongapura stuff? It was the money of Hinero Katoni that provoked me. Woke me from the slumber of wondering where I was going. Stumbling through the snow, sleep, trotting along a coast beach. No intention of going where anybody would know me. So as the music maidens, mellifluous notes sing from the mountainous note peaks so deep in the low keys. It's Rongoa and Puoro. You can hear it in the sound in your soul. Nothing compares when it's around. You can feel it in your marker with your pencil. Deep cause of a whānau like a puthorino. We all have a way to us, so watch how you treat your